Hello, and welcome back to the Hayloft Hour. I am your host, Jordan, otherwise known as Spotted Bay Productions. I have been viewing the world through the ears of a horse since I was 2 years old, and this podcast is my attempt at uncovering the dark side of the equine industry. True crime, scandals, and horror stories that might otherwise stay locked away in the hayloft forever. My purpose is to make these stories well known so that we can make sure they never happen again, and to let others know who may find themselves in these situations that they are not alone. Make sure to join us on social media to follow my daily life with my two horses. You can find us on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube, all at Spotted Bay Productions. If you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe wherever you listen and share it with your friends. If you have an episode suggestion or a personal story that you would like to submit, email it to me at spottedbay@gmail.com or submit it in my contact form at spottedbay.com. But please leave out the personal info and just leave behind the juicy details. In today's episode, we will be covering the case of Ali Dar, a thoroughbred racing legend who was euthanized at 15 years old after a tragic injury that some say may not have been an accident. There are mentions of horse injuries and euthanasia in this podcast, so if you're not comfortable with any of those things, feel free to skip this episode and we will see you next time. All information in this podcast has been found online and compiled for your listening pleasure. Inaccuracies or out-of-date information is always a possibility. This is for educational purposes only, and everything is alleged or speculation unless proven in court. Most information in this episode is hearsay, and only part of it has been proven in court and led to indictment, so please remember that as you listen and draw your own conclusions about what you think happened. Let's get into the story. Driving through Lexington, Kentucky makes horse lovers feel like they've died and gone to heaven. Mile by mile, you drive past some of the most beautiful horse farms you could imagine. Rolling green hills, historic stone walls, iconic plank fencing, and sometimes guarded gates at the entrances. While these farms appear pristine from the road, many have sordid histories that have been locked away in haylofts or buried in the pasture, and Calumet is no exception. Calumet Farm was started in 1924 by William Monroe Wright. Wright found his success as an entrepreneur when he started Calumet Baking Powder Company. Wright's initial plan with the farm was to breed standardbred race horses. However, when Wright's son Warren took over the farm after his death in 1932, the shift was made to thoroughbred race horses. Calumet spent decades churning out champion horses, including 1941 Triple Crown winner Whirlaway, 1948 Triple Crown winner Citation, who has often been held in similar esteem to Manowar, and Secretariat. Citation was also the first thoroughbred to achieve millionaire status. They also owned Bull Lee, who was a 5-time leading sire. Warren Wright died in 1950, leaving behind his wife to look after the farm. Mrs. Lucille Wright eventually remarried Jean Markey in 1952. Warren and Lucille Wright did have one child together. However, he had no interest in the horse business and also ended up in prison for not paying his income taxes. Things were good for a few years until their trainer, Ben Jones, passed away after 20 years at the farm. This marked the end of an era. After the loss of Mr. Jones, Calumet did not receive any more leading owner or breeder titles. Bull Lee died in 1964, and from then on, the success of Calumet Racing continued to decline. In 1976, the farm hired a new trainer, Mr. John Veitch. And under the eye of Mr. Veitch, the farm became home to one of the most famous racehorses of his time, Ali Dar. Ali Dar was born on March 23, 1975. He was a chestnut colt by Raisa native out of On and On. Ali Dar was short for Ali Darling, the nickname Mrs. Wright had for her dear friend, the Ali Khan. Ali Dar had a famous rivalry with Affirmed, the 1978 Triple Crown winner. Had Affirmed and Ali Dar not gone head-to-head in all three races, Ali Dar may have held the Triple Crown himself, having come in second to Affirmed in the Derby, the Preakness, and the Belmont. Over his career, Ali Dar had 26 starts, winning 14 of them and earning just shy of $1 million. During his breeding career, his stud fee, with a guarantee, was $250,000, and in his last year of breeding, he covered nearly 100 mares. His final yearling crop consisted of 32 horses that sold for an average auction price of nearly $500,000. Aladar's stud fee wasn't always this high, having started at a mere $40,000. This was brought into question by Mrs. Wright's grandson-in-law, J.T. Lundy. Lundy was not who Mrs. Wright would have chosen to marry her granddaughter. It had been said that Cindy, Mrs. Wright's eldest granddaughter, was not interested in the traditions of the upper class, nor did she want to marry a college-educated aristocrat's son. She liked Lundy, who preferred racing his car down Kentucky side roads and thought a bucket of chicken wings was a nice date night. Lundy was extremely ambitious and wanted to get into the horse industry, even allegedly choosing to marry Cindy because of her ties to the extremely successful Calumet Farms. Lundy was even running his own successful farm with Cindy. Mrs. Wright lost the fight to keep Lundy off of her farm when she died in 1982. Some of the other heirs to Calumet weren't interested in running a horse farm and granted management power to Lundy. The keys to Calumet were finally in Lundy's hands, and he wasted no time on improvements to the farm and spared no expense. Lundy installed iron entrance gates, repainted 23 miles of fencing, built a veterinary clinic that also held a treadmill and swimming pool, new waterers, a turf track, and of course, more horses. In order to jumpstart all of these projects, Lundy took out a loan in 1983 for over $13 million. With Aladar's raging success as a stud and Calumet's reputation, bankers never hesitated to loan Lundy the money. The $13 million wasn't enough for Lundy's plans, though, and Aladar's normal stud fees weren't going to cut it either. Soon after taking the farm, Lundy created an opportunity for Aladar's fans. Lifetime breeding rights. Instead of paying $250,000 per breeding, ambitious breeders could pay Calumet $2.5 million for the right to have one mare covered by Aladar per year for the rest of his breeding career. At the time, it seemed like a great deal, considering the prices Aladar babies were bringing at auction, sometimes over $2 million. Lundy had really made it big. A country boy from a Kentucky holler was now being wined and dined by the finest in the Kentucky thoroughbred industry in hopes of having their best mares selected for the privilege of a date with the famous Aladar. It didn't take long, though, for Lundy to lose his grip on the farm's wallet. He was spending $30,000 a month to lease a private jet, purchased vacation property, added even more renovations to the farm, and even sponsored an Indy race car. This now big shot horseman had it all, except for his wife. Cindy was allegedly put off by being second fiddle to the farm and was said to not often be around. Lundy even found himself a girlfriend who worked in the farm office. With expenses piling up, Lundy took out more loans, totaling somewhere around $100 million. A large portion of this money was loaned during a 1986 economic slump that was tied to the oil market collapse and some tax law restructuring. Folks in the racing industry were blown away that Lundy was able to keep bringing in so much money while they were just fighting to keep afloat. It turned out Lundy had a stroke of luck when he chose to apply for a loan at Houston's First City Bank Corporation, one of the largest bank holding companies in Texas. Now, as for why Lundy went to a Texas bank, I have no idea, and some others question this too. But how many questions are you really going to ask someone who's willing to loan you millions of dollars? Probably not many. The banker with whom Lundy and Calumet's CFO Gary Matthews worked with was Frank C. Sheock. Sheock had a reputation exactly like you'd expect of a big city banker. Ruthless and overconfident. Sheock was made for the dog-eat-dog world of banking and had worked his way up to his position where he could now approve loans up to $120 million without having to go through a traditional loan committee. One of the first loans he made soon after taking on First City was to Calumet for nearly $50 million. While Lundy and Matthews did hand over financial statements for this loan, Sheock told the loan officers that they didn't need to look at Calumet's records and just give them the loan. He thought that by having the famous Calumet as one of their clients, this would bring in other big-time horse clients and thus more money. Only a few weeks after the initial loan, Calumet was already out of money and needed another loan. Sheock again signed off without hesitation, thinking that Calumet would bounce back and everything would be fine. Like I said, Alidar was covering over 100 mares per year sometimes, and at $250,000 a pop, that should help get Calumet back on its feet. Shiok continued to oversee the Calumet loan until he suddenly resigned from his position at First City in October of 1990. This was when Calumet got the call that it was time to start paying on these loans. The bank gave Calumet until February of 1991 to pay back at least $15 million, otherwise they would proceed with foreclosure on the farm and seize all of the assets, including the horses. Even with Alidar's success, things had been in decline at Calumet for several years. Alidar was America's leading sire in 1990, and some of his sons were winning various races and honors, but for the most part, Calumet Farm's success had sizzled out, and things were only about to get worse. On November 13, 1990, only a few weeks after getting word about possible foreclosure on the farm, a panicked call was made to veterinarians after finding Alidar down in his stall. Not only was the country's leading sire down, he was drenched in sweat and his right hind leg was badly fractured. Some sources say that the leg was quite literally hanging on by a thread, while others say Alidar was only favoring his left leg. J.T. Lundy told vets that Alidar had done this to himself by kicking his solid oak stall door. Whether or not that sounded feasible wasn't important in the moment. The important thing was obvious. Save Alidar. Veterinarians performed emergency surgery on the horse's cannon bone to set the leg and created a cast. Alidar pulled through surgery and was back on all fours. If you're interested in veterinary medicine, the Blood Horse article that I've cited in this episode, which you can find on my website, has an incredibly detailed description of how the surgery was completed and even has photographs of the surgery. I'm not going to go into details here of the specifics of the surgery and such because it's not super relevant to the case, but it's really interesting and super cool that they do have pictures of Alidar on the operating table and things like that. It's definitely a reminder that we are extremely lucky here in Lexington to have vets like Root and Riddle in town who can handle these kinds of emergencies. After surgery, Alidar was placed in a padded recovery room and required the aid of a sling to stand. He fought the cast and lost his balance a few times. Folks who were there said Alidar was just absolutely not a fan of the cast, the sling, or the entire situation, and he was just really over it all. However, after a few hours of being back in his stall, he was starting to be more alert and was happily munching on his hay. Overnight, though, the stress of the whole situation just really started to get to Alidar, and he started showing symptoms of colic. When the sling was removed to try to get him moving to keep the colic from getting worse, Alidar lost his balance and fractured his right femur. At this point, all parties knew that the best thing that they could do for Alidar was to take away his pain. So soon after, Alidar was laid to rest. The loss of Alidar sent shockwaves through horse racing fans. How could such a pristine athlete be gone so quickly from such a freak accident? It is said by those who were at Calumet Farms on the night of Alidar's accident that Lundy was in absolute and utter shock at the entire situation. While rumors began to circulate about the horse's death, J.T. Lundy was busy with insurance companies. Alidar had been insured with two different insurance companies, and his death was worth a $32 million payout. While Alidar had been a somewhat successful racehorse, most of this insurance was to cover the income that would be earned from breeding for the remainder of the horse's expected lifespan. The sudden accident combined with the massive payout got people thinking that maybe this was not the accident it seemed. This was all occurring at a similar time as the Sandman scandal, which I briefly covered in the Helen Brock episode, so people were a little on edge about mysterious horse deaths and insurance payouts. The fracture in Alidar's leg, though, was not a shatter-type fracture, as if someone had hit him with something trying to break his leg, and that was one of the leading accusations swirling around, but the records and statements from the vet just did not line up with that. It didn't help that even folks who worked at Calumet were allegedly divided over the whole thing. One of the foremen from the Stallion Barn said he couldn't have imagined Alidar kicking something hard enough to knock it off its hinges, let alone break his leg in the process. Part of the whole scene when the insurance people and the vets and everything got there was that Alidar had kicked the stall so hard that the wheel that kept the stall on its stall door on its tracks had come off of its bracket on the floor. There's pictures of it, again, in some of the linked articles. If you're interested in seeing that, they're on my website. But even as I was reading through this case, I had to wonder how hard a horse would have to kick. Even as I read through this case, though, I had to wonder how hard a horse would have to kick a solid oak door in a very fancy and surely well-built barn in order to break it off of its hinge. I've seen horses kick much less sturdy surfaces that still didn't break. If a horse as valuable as Alidar was such a bad stall kicker, why would there not be precautions taken? Why would you not do something to prevent the injury, whether that was padding or whatever? I mean, we're not talking about your grumpy gelding at feeding time. This is Alidar. This is the $250,000 a date thoroughbred racing legend that we're talking about. Surely they would do anything to protect him if this was a regular occurrence. There was never really investigation into that part of it, though. It seemed to be a pretty open and shut case, backed by expert witnesses, including the veterinarians who worked with Alidar. The first insurance company had an adjuster on scene the night of the accident who allegedly didn't ask many questions of any witnesses and pretty much bought the whole thing as a tragic accident. Another company that insured Alidar was denied access until the following day, and by the time they were able to investigate the scene, everything had been cleaned up. Being that Alidar was one of the only shining stars left at Calumet, his demise brought the farm down with it. By 1992, the farm declared bankruptcy, the horses were sold off, and the land was put up for auction. This was pretty much the end of things until some red flags were raised in a U.S. attorney's office in 1996 in Houston, Texas. Julia Tamala, then Julia Hyman, was working in her role investigating Texas financial institutions in order to expose white-collar crime such as money laundering. She had been tasked with investigating the failure of several Texas financial institutions from 1986 to 1992. She also worked with a rookie partner, Rob Foster. One of the players in these failures was someone she would proceed to bring down multiple times, Frank Sheock. Tamala had put Sheock in prison first for his scheme to pull loan and fee money from First City Bank for his consultants, who then gave him a commission of their profits. Tamala eventually uncovered more of these schemes arranged by Sheock, for which she got him a 22-year sentence. While reading through some records from one of these financial institutions, some paperwork containing Alidar's name caught her eye. She really didn't know anything about horses or racing, but was curious as to why Sheock was so interested in lending to large horse farms. It turns out that Sheock was a racing fan himself. Sheock had received over $1 million from an entity out of Kentucky named Equine Capital Corporation, or ECC. It turned out that the ECC was just a cover for what was really happening. Lundy and Matthews had floated money through the ECC to Sheock. This was supposedly a loan to Sheock, but no communication occurred about this loan's repayment. It was found that Sheock used the money from Lundy to lease two broodmares at Calumet and have them bred by Alidar. Also included in this deal was a breeding to Secreto, another horse that they had on the farm that was doing pretty well, and that horse's normal stud fee was $125,000, but in this communication with Sheock, they were only charging him $1 for a breeding. In exchange for all of this special treatment at Calumet, Sheock was to push through all the loans Calumet could ever need. To be fair, it seems like if Alidar is breeding as many mares as he was for as much as it costs, it shouldn't be that hard for Calumet to pay back its loans. A journalist, however, was the one that discovered that often Lundy was giving out Alidar's services for free. Lundy would use Alidar breedings for bartering, for other things he wanted, or would give them out to his friends. I think it's fair to say that Lundy was more concerned with seeming like the big shot who could afford to hand out breedings to the prestigious Alidar than he was about actually running a profitable business. He had everything, the farm's reputation, millions of dollars of credit from the bank, and a stallion that was dang near an ATM. While Alidar was insured for millions of dollars, that coverage wasn't going to last forever. Alidar was being bred so often that he was becoming sore in his hind end, and Calumet wasn't having any other successes. This meant that not only could they not make payments on their astronomical loans that had been building, it also meant they weren't able to pay their insurance premiums on time. By fall of 1990, one of Alidar's insurers let Calumet know that due to lack of payment, the insurance coverage on Alidar would end in December of 1990. All of this started to add up to a very clear case for Tamala and Foster. Calumet was failing and Lundy saw an out, but he had to act before the insurance policy on Alidar ended. As one article I read stated, Alidar was suddenly worth more dead than he was alive. Tamala kept pushing further into her suspicion that something just wasn't right. She contacted the veterinarian who had been at Calumet that night, but when asked if she had Alidar's x-rays, she said they had gone missing. The veterinarian also said when Alton Stone, the night watchman, called her, he only said to come up when she had a chance to look at Alidar, but not that anything was serious. So, let's review. In the fall of 1990, the bank had told Lundy that he was going to have to pay back his loans, or the farm could go into foreclosure and they would have all of their assets seized, the horses would be sold off, and all of that. Also around that time, the insurance company said, hey, you're not making your payments on time, so when your policy on Alidar expires in December, we're not going to cover him anymore. So we have this gap between the fall, when the bank said, hey, we want our money, and December, when Alidar's insurance was going to end, and right in the middle was November, and that is exactly when Alidar died. Just wanted to point out the timeline again. By 1996, subpoenas were being sent out to those who had been present during the entire tragedy at Calumet. Tom Dixon, the insurance adjuster who'd been on the scene, was one of those subpoenaed for all of his records relating to the Alidar case. The Blood Horse article that is cited on my website for this episode was written by Tom Dixon and provided a lot of the information that I've used here. Dixon writes about how during his testimony, he was questioned by the U.S. attorney about his statement regarding Alidar being killed for insurance money, but this was a statement that Dixon insists he never made. It took until June of 1997 to track down Stone, who was at the time working construction. When he gave his version of events to Tamala, he said that he had gone with the security guard to buy sodas, and then upon their return, they saw the injured Alidar. So these two employees of Calumet had just gone off to grab a quick refreshment, and in the time they were gone, Alidar had broken his leg, and that was what they found when they returned from their little break. So Stone, the night watchman, it was not his normal night to work. He was actually standing in for the other watchman, Harold Kipp, who had asked for the night off. When the security guard was interviewed, he had a different recollection of what happened. The guard, whose name was Keed Hidley, said he had never been with Stone, but that he had stopped by the Stallion Barn to use the telephone there. While on the phone with his wife, Hidley heard Alidar whinny. When he finished on the phone, he went to see Alidar and noticed the injury to his leg, and Hidley said he then radioed Stone to call the veterinarian. So we have two very different stories from Stone and from Hidley. Stone says, yeah, we went to grab some sodas and we came back and Alidar had broken his leg. But Hidley says he wasn't even with Stone. He was just on his own doing his job. And of course, this is in the 90s, so it was not like people just whipped out their iPhone to text their wife. He went to the Stallion Barn to use the phone there and call his wife from there. And when he got off the phone, because he had heard Alidar Winnie, he went to check on him and then radioed Stone and then they got the vet. So two very different versions of events here. So during the investigation, Tamala also interviewed Kipp. And like I said, Kipp was the night watchman who was supposed to be working that night, but had supposedly asked for the night off. But when Tamala interviewed both Kipp and Hidley, so this is the night watchman who asked for the night off and the security guard who had said he was just in the Stallion Barn to use the phone. They both said this is the first time that anyone had ever interviewed them about anything to do with Alidar. And remember, this is almost 7 years later that they're now being interviewed. So even though one of them was there that night and one of them should have been there that night, nobody ever asked them any questions. They just went with it. So Kip, the night watchman who had asked for the night off, reported to Tamala that a few days before Alidar's injury, he was approached by a dark blue Crown Victoria car with tinted windows, and this was on the farm at Calumet. This man, who Kip had seen before on the farm but didn't really know, got out of the car and told Kip that there was some concern that he was starting to get burned out in his job. But Kip really loved his job and would rarely, if ever, take a day off. Kip actually even continued doing night watch at Calumet when it was taken over by the new owner after bankruptcy. So he really liked being there and really didn't think that he needed to take some time off. But this mysterious man told Kip that he should take the day off on Tuesday, November 13th. Like, a very specific date. That's when the company needs you to take your required PTO is this one specific Tuesday. I mean, Kip thought this was weird, but he was like, well, this guy must work for Lundy, my employer, and I'm not one to, like, make waves. If they want me to take the night off, whatever, I'll find something to do. But he said that he never asked Stone to take his shift for him, which is what Stone had originally told investigators. So again, Stone and Kip have very different versions of how even these little things happened that aren't inherently directly related to Alidar getting hurt, but just related to the situation. So after both Kip and Hailey had given different accounts of events surrounding Alidar's death than Stone did, Tamala and Foster put Stone on trial for perjury for telling false stories in previous investigations. So perjury isn't normally a crime that would be brought on its own in federal court. It might be in addition to another crime, but it's not very common for someone to just be put on federal trial for perjury. But Tamala was hoping that she would get Stone talking to try to get his way out of this perjury charge, and then by doing that, she could find out what really happened in the Alidar case. U.S. Marshals tried to find Lundy to testify during Stone's trial, but he was missing. They couldn't find him anywhere. Lundy had basically disappeared after the bankruptcy in 1992, and at some point after he declared personal bankruptcy, and during that time, he did show up in Lexington for a hearing that was related to his personal bankruptcy. And he basically showed up and pled the Fifth Amendment like hundreds of times and acted super nervous. And it's documented in the court transcription from his hearing or whatever. And that was pretty much it. That was the last trace that people knew of him. Another person that was called to testify was Marcia Matthews. Marcia was the former wife of Calumet's CFO, Gary Matthews, and he and Lundy were the ones who were always kind of doing the sketchy bank stuff. And she testified that she had heard Lundy telling her husband, Gary, in a conversation regarding Calumet's debt that there are ways to get rid of the horse. This testimony was declared inadmissible by the judge in the case. However, the judge did allow testimony from a reporter who had heard a similar sentiment from Stone. This was Carol Flake, the same reporter who had discovered that Alidar was often being bred for free, and she interviewed Stone in 1992, and he allegedly told her that Lundy knew something was going to happen to Alidar. So this Stone guy just seems really suspicious. Regardless of what you think really happened to Alidar, this guy seems like he just can't get his story straight ever. So all of these small bits of evidence seemed to add up to something being fishy, but it wasn't enough for a grand jury to indict anyone for murdering Alidar. It's a lot of hearsay and circumstantial evidence, basically, and there's just not hard proof, I guess, for them to really say, oh, this person killed Alidar for insurance money. It wasn't until 1999, so we're now 9 years after Alidar was laid to rest, that Tamala decided to try one more time. Tamala convinced the grand jury to indict Lundy and Matthews for bank fraud, conspiracy, and bribery regarding the $1.1 million that was paid to Sheok through the ECC, as well as for defrauding First City of $65 million in loans. Both men were put on trial for this and were found guilty. One humorous point that was made in the trial was by Lundy's attorney, and I don't know if this attorney was just like a rookie or just genuinely had no other defense to go off of, but the attorney takes Lundy, stands him up in the courtroom in front of the jury, and asks the jury if they think Lundy looks smart enough to pull something like this off. It wasn't like, oh no, he wasn't there, or like, oh no, he has an alibi, or like, there's not enough evidence for this. It's like, this guy looks way, way too dumb to pull something off like this. Like, that was his best defense he could come up with. Tragic. But anyway, the jury thought that he did look smart enough to pull something like that off, and Lundy was ordered to pay $20.4 million in restitution. So now we come to my favorite part of the story, if there can be in such a tragedy. One of the final witnesses called to the stand was Bai Tamala. The man who took the stand was a professor of electrical engineering and computer science at MIT. This man was also a horseman and on the board of the National Association of Thoroughbred Owners Racetrack Safety Commission. The man's name was Dr. George Pratt. Tamala and Foster didn't believe that Alidar could kick the solid oak stall door off its track, as witnesses stated. The door was a rolling type, like I said, that had the wheel bolted into the concrete outside of the stall, which kept the door on its track. It was noted at the time of Alidar's accident that he had kicked the door so hard that it busted the wheel off of the bolts that held it to the floor. It was said that the bottom of the bolts were left embedded in the concrete, and then new ones were installed to replace the wheel. Tamala, Foster, and their team went to Calumet and walked in the barn and cut a chunk of the concrete out of the floor where the bolts allegedly were, the leftover pieces that had been shorn off when Alidar allegedly kicked the stall. And they took this concrete, this chunk of concrete, with the photographs that had been taken by the insurance adjuster, and sent it up to MIT so that this guy could, like, investigate it. And the photograph was taken to show that the roller was lying on the floor with the top halves of the bolts. So we have pictures of the bolts and the roller and, like, how everything was kind of situated. So when Dr. Pratt received this evidence, he right away looked at the tops and the bottoms of the bolts, because if they've been kicked and broken in half, the two halves of the bolts should match up, right? Well, they didn't. And the way that the bolts were broken didn't match how they should have been broken if the impact was from the inside of the stall. The way that the bolts had been broken, the impact would have had to come from the outside of the stall. Not only did Dr. Pratt investigate the bolts, he also came to Calumet to investigate and take measurements of the stall, because he wanted to really get in the situation and figure out, okay, like, how did this really happen. He used all of this information to write an equation to determine how much force would be required by a horse's kick to knock the roller off of its hinges. The equation gave him the result that 6,600 pounds of force would be required to perform this task. The kicker, though, is that even the strongest horses can only kick with about 1,000 to 2,000 pounds of force. This testimony was written off by Dixon in his article, which is where he says that Dr. Pratt didn't know the age or the type of bolts or even have photos of them. So, I don't know. It seems like there's a lot of conflicting information in the way people recount this case, which is why I still can't figure out how I feel about it. This should have been the smoking gun, right? You literally have someone who has a math equation to show you that there's no way that Alidar could have kicked the stall hard enough to knock the wheel off of its bolts. However, the judge was not convinced, and while he agreed that there was motive and opportunity for Lundy to have murdered Alidar, he couldn't say for sure that Lundy was guilty of this crime. And with that, Lundy was only sentenced to 4 years in prison for bribery, and Matthews was given 21 months. Lundy was released on December 28, 2004, and served 3 years of probation after his release. Matthews was released in December of 2002. I can't really find anything about Lundy after his release. It's like he just kind of disappeared from the face of the earth. Some online forums speculate that he had stashed money somewhere, like offshore, and was living off of that. And others say he won't show his face after what he did to Calumet, because regardless of whether or not you think he killed Alidar or not, he definitely tanked Calumet financially, so you probably wouldn't want to go back into the horse world after that. But I did find a forum. Posts on the forum were from, like, 2014, and someone said that they had seen JT Lundy at a Keeneland sale in 2014. Whether that's true or not, I can't say. It's not the most reputable source, but there's that. When Calumet declared its bankruptcy, it was purchased by a trust started by Henrik de Kwiatkowski. And the trust eventually sold the farm to Calumet Investment Group in 2012, who then leased it to Brad M. Kelly. The farm has had some success in recent years, with Calumet's Oxbow winning the Preakness Stakes in 2013. The original silks of the farm, which were really iconic red and blue, they were sold as part of the asset auction to, like, a Brazilian racing group, I guess, and have been now replaced with the Kelly's black and gold silks. I do want to point out here that a lot of what I'm finding about this case is from a perspective that's probably biased, but I wasn't there, so I can't say whose words are the truth, and I can't really take anyone's side. I just have to summarize what I've found online. And I feel like everything that I can possibly read about this has a bias, because there's only two kinds of people that are going to write about this, right? There's the people who were involved in the situation or are closely tied to the situation and feel like they need to defend themselves. And the other kind are people who think that Lundy killed Alidar, or had Alidar killed on purpose, and that it's a whole, like, a conspiracy kind of thing. So there's not a lot of people who are sitting in the middle and just trying to look at all the information and present it as it is, which is what I'm trying to do. I really thought that I was going to come into this and be like, oh yeah, like he definitely killed Alidar, you know, but it wasn't proven in court, and there was just a lot of things I think that maybe weren't done correctly to have hard evidence. But then I also consider, well, I'm reading an article from the insurance adjuster, and an insurance adjuster who approved a $30 million payout is obviously going to defend themselves and say that they did their job right, and, you know, it seemed like an accident to them, so they're not going to turn around and be like, oh yeah, I probably gave a $30 million payout and I was wrong, oops, you know? So I think it's hard when you're looking at people's perspective, and you don't want to call someone's integrity into question just because you want a juicy story out of it. So I've tried really hard to kind of look at everything. But something else I thought about was, what if Alidar did kick the stall door hard enough to break his leg, but someone made him do it? I mean, it's not outside the realm of possibility that a hot shot or something like that can cause a horse to kick. And I'm not a veterinarian, so I can't say much about the fracture itself. I wasn't there to say what the scene looked like. I do wonder, though, if Lundy was willing to bribe and pay off a banker, would he not be willing to do the same to, like, an insurance adjuster or a veterinarian or a farmhand or any of the above? Do you know what I mean? I don't think that's outside the realm of possibility. And one of the articles did say that Stone, that was the night watchman who was there that night, he allegedly admitted that Lundy was responsible for what happened to Alidar, but he didn't give any other details. So I just don't really know what to think. I want to think that no horse person, no matter how desperate, would do something that cruel to their horse. And I'd like to think that even if Lundy did want to kill Alidar for insurance money, that he would choose something much more humane than breaking the horse's leg. Like, that is one of the worst things that I could think of as far as, like, a horse's demise. Broken bones and colic are, like, the two, you know what I mean? So, I want to believe that somebody would not do that. But I also feel like $30 million for the insurance policy is kind of a drop in the bucket for how much debt Lundy was in. So does it really make sense to get a quick check of $30 million? And then after that, you basically have no other income, because really all they had going for them for the most part was Alidar. So if you off your only source of income, you have no way to pay the rest of your bills, you know? So, like, wouldn't it make more sense to just keep breeding him? And, I mean, if you're covering 100 mares a year at $250,000 a pop, you can pay off $65 million in just over a couple of years. So, I don't know. That part, that the financial part doesn't really make sense to me. Like, it doesn't seem like a good way to get yourself out of something. So I feel like there were maybe more things going on beneath the surface that could have contributed to this, but there's just no evidence of it. But I'm also like, well, maybe there were some less savory characters that had maybe given Lundy loans and Lundy wasn't paying them back. So they did something to Alidar because they wanted their money. Do you know what I mean? Like an illicit loan situation, like, pay us our money back, we're gonna break your kneecaps, except it's your horse. So I don't know. Like I said, there's no evidence of that, but I'm just trying to think of all the possibilities. Either Lundy's guilty, Lundy's not guilty, Lundy's maybe a little bit guilty. You know, it's like there's a lot of different options there. And I don't know what it is. But like I said, I really thought that I was gonna walk into this case and be like, yep, Lundy killed Alidar, got his insurance money, got away with it. But I've been down a lot of rabbit holes on the internet, and I'm just really not sure what I think happened. And I'm not the only one, and I really don't think the world will ever know. When I was finishing up writing this case, I happened upon a mention of lead poisoning that Alidar suffered in 1983. Apparently some lead paint had blown off of the roof of the barn and was ingested by Alidar. Lundy said the horse was sick and acting drunk for a month, and he credits the veterinarian for fast action to treat the poisoning to save the horse. Another form said that even though Calumet had used lead-free paint, the veterinarian knew that lead-free paint could still contain up to 1% lead, and so Alidar must have just eaten enough to still poison himself. So I'm like, well, maybe he's just an accident-prone horse, and this is within the realm of possibility. And I've heard other people say, no, I've heard of horses kicking the stall hard enough to break their leg, and I've also heard of that, but to me, I would think hairline fracture, or, you know, not this complete blowout leg hanging on by a thread kind of fracture. But again, I'm not a vet, so I can't really say. I'm just speculating. I also, ironically, right before I was recording this episode, ran into someone who was a vet tech in the area at the time of the whole Alidar case, and she and, like, everybody she knows is dead set on the fact that it was not an accident, and it was done on purpose, and that Lundy was a bad person, and all these other things. But again, I don't know Lundy, and I think of the way conspiracy theories travel now, and they travel so much faster now, but, I mean, even in the 90s, it wasn't like it was all over Facebook, right? It was just word of mouth. So if one person goes, oh, well, I didn't like Lundy, so he must have done it on purpose, and then that's what spreads, well, now everybody assumes that. So I don't think I'll ever really settle on this case unless something new comes out, but I doubt it. When I posted my teaser video on TikTok about this episode, I had so many things in the comments and in my DMs. I even had someone in my DMs claiming that Calumet was their family's farm and they know Lundy didn't do it because Lundy loved Alidar, and that's their family and their family could never do that. But they didn't address the fact that Lundy also, like, was convicted for financial crimes on a federal level. So, and I think, I mean, I guess I can't say for sure, but if your close friend or family does some kind of crime like that, a lot of times you're just, even if they were convicted, you're going to just be convinced that there's no possible way they could do that, when obviously they must have, because they went to prison for it. I mean, not that people don't get wrongly convicted, but with a crime like this, I think it's a little bit different when it's like, here's the paper trail of what you did wrong, you know? So, as I said, even many years later, this is still an extremely divisive topic, and the only ones who truly know what happened will probably take any secrets they may have to their grave. Rest easy, Alidar.
Speed duel beginning to develop. On the inside, affirmed. On the outside, Alidar. And those two are letting out all stops. They're going on out together. Affirmed along the inside. Alidar on the outside. Heads apart as they move down the back stretch. Then they've opened six lengths on Noontime Spender and Judge Advocate. And the trailer is still Darby Creek Road. Three quarters, however, went in 1:14. The pace is still slow. They're moving into the turn. Affirmed holding ahead in front, and Alidar on the outside is challenging again. It's Affirmed by ahead on the turn. Alidar is second by 4.5. Along the inside, Judge Advocate, Noontime Spender, and Darby Creek Road now beginning to pick up the pace. Three quarters went in 14, a mile in 37.2. The pace is increasing as they come to the head of the stretch. It is still Affirmed as they come to the quarter pole. He's holding on to a head lead. Alidar is outside of him and challenging that lead. The two are heads apart, and Alidar's got a lead. Alidar put a head in front, right in the middle of the stretch. It's Alidar and Affirmed battling back along the inside. We'll test these two to the wire. Affirmed under a left-hand whip. Alidar on the outside driving. Affirmed and Alidar heads apart. Affirmed's got a nose in front as they come.